The start of the week and lots to hear from the day on Radio 1. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
I was so traumatized and I didn't even want to think about what I went through. Now that I'm an adult, I realize that I built the character as a trauma response and almost a mask just to go into this world and be thrown into Hollywood, which is a very difficult place as well.
AI was going along nicely in the background, and a couple of years ago, it flipped from being classification and recognition to being generation. And that's where we have the ChatGPT stuff. It is generating text as answers.
Your Charleston was exceptional.
That was the worst week of my life.
Yeah, it was.
And we'll start in the afternoon. One of the first big reality TV stars, Paris Hilton, was talking to Ray Darcy.
Paris Hilton was the quintessential it girl at the turn of the century. As the great-granddaughter of the founder of the Hilton Hotels, Conrad Hilton, she was born into American royalty and was catapulted to worldwide fame with the explosion of the internet and her incredibly successful reality show, The Simple Life. But behind the glamour and perceived perfection was a more complex story of a young woman navigating the world around her with yet undiagnosed ADHD and an horrific time spent in so-called emotional growth boarding schools at a very young age. In her new memoir, we meet a very honest and courageous Paris Hilton, and she joins us now on the line from London. Hello, Paris.
Hello.
Good to talk to you. One of the quotes in the book that stood out for me was from Elliot Mintz. He says, "You're a woman who lived eight lives at once." So we might get to maybe five of those lives. We'll see how we go. but your first memory, this is like mad first memory, is being on the lap of Andy Warhol.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my mom and dad were friends with him and used to go out with him to Studio 54. And then they would sometimes like have after parties at the Waldorf, and I would sit on his lap and draw, and he loved me and just always told my mom, one day this girl's going to be a huge star.
And he was right. and going back to your great-grandfather, he was featured in the Elvis movie. He was the man who signed the contract with Colonel Tom Parker, was he, to get Elvis to do his Vegas residency?
Yes, my grandfather was such a pioneer and was the first to bring Las Vegas residencies and had Elvis at the Las Vegas Hilton for hundreds of shows.
Wow, that's mad, isn't it? You were told all these stories as a child, were you, Paris?
Yes, I just grew up hearing just all the amazing stories about my family, and just my grandfather was always a business mentor to me and I looked up to him so much.
Mm. Like an unreal world for most of us, but it was your normal. That's the thing. can we talk about ADHD? So you're in your 20s when you got a diagnosis?
Yes. So I had no idea as a teenager.
And what do you understand ADHD to be, and how does it affect you in your life?
Well, when I was a teenager, people were not talking about it. So I really had no idea why, but I just really couldn't concentrate in school. And it just was very difficult for me with everything, just memorizing things, being able to be responsible. And now I realize that if you can harness it in the correct way, it's actually a superpower. And my whole career, I've really thought outside the box and have been an innovator and someone who takes risks. So I see it actually as a positive attribute now.
Yeah, it is a superpower, isn't it? Because it allows you, it gives you an energy, does it?
It really does. It gives you this energy that I think that other people who don't have it don't understand really.
Yeah. I suppose people who watched the documentary will want to read the book, because this is a companion book for the documentary and a lot of the same themes and stories are covered. And the big one, and this was the most revealing one, is about your time in what's described as residential treatment facilities.
They call them emotional growth boarding schools.
Aha, right. Mm-hmm. And one of the... They were sort of advertising. They showed a bit of a clip of one of the videos that was advertising one of those schools. And there's a quote from it. "It's for teenage boys and girls who need a change of attitude and direction." So are these fee-paying reformatory schools? Would that be a good way of describing them?
It's both. People can be private paid, or they're from the juvenile justice system, from just different parts, but it's all children from everywhere.
Okay, but all labelled as, and I'm doing the inverted commas here, troubled.
Yes. A lot of the kids in there just only had ADHD and people didn't understand it back then.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that's
so I wasn't even a
it?
Bad kid. Like, all I did was sneak out at night, got bad grades, was getting kicked out of school. Yeah. So I didn't deserve to go to somewhere like that.
Of course you didn't.
And Paris spoke about the treatment she received in emotional growth boarding school.
There are these schools and there's thousands of them around the world now. It's a multi-billion dollar industry with over 150,000 children being sent to a year. And they're supposed to be to grow you emotionally, but they just, the staff that work at these places are extremely abusive and just try to break you down. And it was just a terrifying experience being verbally and emotionally and physically abused by these people.
So you outlined there were cavity searches and you weren't just verbally abused by the staff. You were encouraged to verbally abuse each other in an evening session called The Rap.
Yes, it was. They really wanted just to put everyone against each other and they wanted everyone not to trust each other. And it was, I don't understand the point of what they were doing for that reason, but it was so traumatizing to be in that room.
Yeah, and even from the start, you were taken forcefully from your bed in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. That's the way that they handle things in these places. They have these people called transporters. And it's something that has given me nightmares ever since I was 16.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book and in the documentary. And it sounds horrific. And this recurring mantra that you hear, we can do this the hard way or the easy way. What was that with reference to?
Well, the two men came into my room at like 4:30 in the morning and they held up handcuffs and said, "Do you want to go the easy way or the hard way?" And I had no idea who they were. I thought they were kidnapping me. It was very scary. And they don't explain to you where you're going or what's happening. So it's completely
horrific.
Traumatizing. It's
yes.
Horrific.
Yeah. And I'm trying to understand where your parents fit in all this. 'Cause they knew, but they didn't know. Is that fair to say?
They had no idea. My parents thought I was going to a normal boarding school. These places have such deceptive marketing where they have brochures and websites with stock photos of happy, smiling kids with rainbows in the background and riding horses. And it looks like these beautiful properties. But people have no idea what's happening behind closed doors. So my parents did not know.
So there's a physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse. This is a new part of your life, and I can feel that, you know, we're meeting now a new Paris Hilton. You've met up with other survivors, Katie and Jessica and others, and you've been campaigning now. You've gone to Washington to campaign to try and shut these places down for good.
Yes, and I'm so proud of all the impact that we've made so far. I've helped change laws in 8 different states. And now I'm going to be going back to D.C. in April to introduce our new bill. And it's already a bipartisan issue. So we have both sides on this. So now I'm just hoping that everyone does the right thing and this bill goes through when we go back in April.
Brilliant. You were living a lie then for a long time, keeping this a secret, portraying this cartoon character of an image. One of the quotes from one of the people who met you, who was a survivor, saying, "I tuned into the simple life and you were saying to the nation that you never cleaned in your life, but you'd done manual labour in those places. You've been down your hands and knees cleaning the floors." So what was, thinking back on keeping that secret and keeping it to yourself, what was that like?
I was so traumatised and I didn't even want to think about what I went through. So I made a promise to myself that I was never going to talk about it. Or I just didn't want this to be a part of my story. It was just so, it hurt me so much to think about. I just tried to not even think about. And now that I'm an adult, I realize that I built the character as a trauma response and almost a mask just to go into this world and be thrown into Hollywood, which is a very difficult place as well.
Paris Hilton from The Ray Darcy Show. And on Morning Ireland, Sean Armstrong has witnessed both Grand Slam wins for Ireland on home soil, 75 years apart. And he was talking to Gavin Jennings.
Ireland's fourth Grand Slam. The first was won in Belfast in 1948. There was a long wait until the second one in 2009. And they've since kept coming. 2018 and now 2023. So what links the first Grand Slam and the most recent one? Both were won in Ireland, and our next guest was there for both, 75 years apart. He's Sean Armstrong, and he's on the phone now. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Gavin.
Have you recovered from Saturday?
Not quite. It was an amazing day from start to finish. I started off on the Enterprise train at lunchtime, and I was escorted onto the train because I'm very well known on that train because I'm a regular visitor to Lansdowne Road, now Aviva. Been there for many years, going back 70 years, and over the last 40-odd years, I've been a member of the patron stub. So I go to all the matches at Aviva, and I take now a different daughter. I have three daughters. I have no sons, but I have three daughters, and I've gotten them all converted to rugby. And we go down to every match, and the one on Saturday was just absolutely amazing. I've never seen the atmosphere before, during, and after the game. And not a person I could see leaving the stadium when the match ended.
Fantastic occasion to be at, Sean, for you and your daughter. Tell me about the first Grand Slam in 1948. Yes. You were in Ravenhill as an 11-year-old, yes?
I was 11, almost 12. The first rugby match I'd been taken to. I started playing rugby for my school, and that got me interested. And then there was a person called Jack Kyle, the out half, who I'm sure is known throughout the world, and he was my boyhood hero. And I think that's what drew me to go to see him playing in that international, and it was a Grand Slam match. The memories are not great, but I do remember that I stood behind the post with my father, and we were able to witness the winning score by J.C. Daly. It was just in front of us. Now, rugby in those days, not as skilled as it is today, and there wasn't obviously the training, and it was a forward rush with the ball kicked over the line, and J.C. Daly managed to touch it down, and that was the score. It was not a very high scoring game, 6-3, but the memories of that, and I have press cuttings here in the scrapbook. I started recording the matches that I went to, and that was the first one. First big match was at Ravenhill, 1948. It's hard to remember many. I don't remember getting to the ground. I don't know how I got there. Travelling was difficult in those days, obviously. And it was amazing. And I have photographs of the crowd. There was supposed to be 30,000 in Ravenhill, and it would break all health and safety rules the way they were packed in the on-reserve side. I was behind the post because it was just rough ground, and there weren't many people there. And I'm not a very tall person, and therefore at 11 I would even been smaller. So it had to be somewhere where I could see. So the memories are, I at the end of the match, and even during the game, the crowd went onto the pitch, because in fact there were people. I've got people sitting here. I can see sitting in seats, and they were dressed quite differently.
Sean Armstrong on Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings. And on today with Claire Byrne, AI, artificial intelligence, and move over ChatGPT. There's another chatbot in town. Alan Smeaton from the Centre for Data Analytics at DCU spoke to Claire.
Now, you're here today to tell us about how we're using AI in our lives, maybe without realising it.
Yeah. There's other applications of artificial intelligence besides ChatGPT. And the area where artificial intelligence first made its impact is in processing images and videos. Mm-hmm. So some of your listeners may remember red eye when you take a photograph and you get those red eyes, and then you'd have to get them edited or doctored out, or you could do it yourself if you wanted to. That's now completely solved by AI. And that's an example, a simple example of the kind of AI that's happening in the background. One of the most successful Christmas books in recent times was Colorizing Old Black and White Images.
Yes.
It was done by a colleague of mine in Galway, John Breslin. And that is using AI techniques. And even every time somebody takes a photograph with your smartphone, that photograph is analysed and indexed by tags or descriptions of what the mm-hmm. content of that image says.
Well, I can go in and I can pick one of my sisters. Okay. Sounds like I have a lot of them. I have four of them, but I can pick one of them.
Okay.
And there'll be a little album there for that person because yeah. the phone has recognised her face. So yeah. I get most of the pictures that I've taken or I've been sent with her face
in it.
That's it, isn't it?
No, it goes beyond that. But you can also use the search button on your smartphone to search for anything. And by anything, I mean like tens of thousands of things, like boats or kikes or sunsets or kayaks or wolves or dogs or microphones or anything.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm looking for a photograph and I remember there was a road in it and there was a bicycle in it and yeah. someone was wearing a hat.
Yeah. So you put in bicycle and it suddenly reduces your 10,000 photographs on your sister's phone down to 50, and you can quickly flick through those.
And that is artificial intelligence.
That is artificial intelligence and is working literally in your hand all of the time. And that's not new, Claire. That's been there for several years.
It's been there for a while, but it's a good example of how we're just incorporating it into our day. And we almost expect that standard yeah. of service from yeah. from our little devices yeah. now. And yeah. so we ask ourselves questions about what AI is going to be able to do. We'll look at what it can do already.
It's creeping in. And it's there and it's literally in your pocket.
I read an article in the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago, about trying to harness the power of it and make sure that it doesn't get out of control. It was quite frightening.
Yeah.
And the example, I'm sure you've heard this example before, but it's a great one. You ask your artificial intelligence software to find iron and it doesn't stop until it takes the iron out of your fillings and your teeth.
yeah.
Now
yeah.
tell me that's not going to happen. Yeah.
No, that's not going to happen. That was Stuart Russell, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it was. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So he's one of the sort of founding fathers of artificial intelligence, and he works in he's a professor in University of California, Berkeley. And I thought he lost the plot a little bit because he talked about AI and controlling AI, and he didn't, however, mention regulating AI. I think he'd been watching too many sci-fi movies, and that's where he's getting you know. And he was a bit of a headline grabber with that article, which I also read. But the thing about AI is that when it appears in our lives, in some cases it is extremely well regulated.
Mm-hmm.
So when AI is used in any kind of healthcare applications or medical diagnosis or surgery, it is extremely regulated. When it is used in finance and market trading, given what we heard earlier on this morning on your show, it is kind of regulated, but it could be regulated even more. It doesn't have a great history of regulation. And then there's other aspects like our social media and the media we're exposed to, where it's completely unregulated.
Yes.
So where we are is that we see AI coming into our lives, and in some spheres it is very well controlled, and in other spheres it is not controlled at all.
So we're relying on humans to control it.
Well, we are and we are not, because even the AI which controls what social media feeds you get is completely not only unregulated, but it's unknown, because those media companies, which then present the content to you, they themselves can't control those mm-hmm. algorithms. So we all live in our own little information bubbles where we get stuff reinforced.
When you were saying there is another better one than ChatGPT coming along or already in place, is that Ernie? Is that the Ernie model?
Ernie was just the day before Patrick's Day. This is how quickly this is moving. Ernie is China's equivalent of ChatGPT for the Western world. It comes from a company called Baidu, who are the big internet search company in China, and they have followed all of the others in that they've come up with their large language model and their chat mm-hmm. equivalent.
And do we know if it's any good?
The launch didn't go so good.
Okay.
No, because during the live example, the examples kind of flopped, and it was a bit embarrassing for them at the time.
So now let's come back to a couple of examples of AI at work at the moment. Facial recognition technology clearly is AI, is it?
Yeah. And that works in your phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as well as in other places, and you know, you can see it in their searching CCTV, and then in cases it can be used for good, and you know, with helping you to find your pictures of your sister on your phone, for example.
Yeah.
And in real deployed applications, searching through large archives of CCTV, where you're looking for that face or that person wearing that those clothes, then yes, it is useful.
And we know it's controversial there too, but at a very basic level, you could get into work with using facial recognition technology
yeah.
and not have to have that card.
Yeah. yeah.
security card, yeah. which we all lose all of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Alan had some more examples of where AI is being used.
AI was going along nicely in the background, and a couple of years ago, it flipped from being classification and recognition to being generation. And that's where we have the ChatGPT stuff. It is generating text as answers. And we're also seeing examples of where it's generating images as mm-hmm. examples. So there's lots of companies available now, which, you know, products available online where you can go and you can describe a picture that you'd like to have automatically generated, and it will go chug, chug, chug. And, you know, within a second or two, you'll have that photograph.
It'll make it.
It'll make that. It'll make that because it has crawled billions of pictures with billions of text descriptions of them. And then when you ask for, you know, show me a picture or generate a picture, it's not show me, it's generate a brand new one. Generate a picture of a family of four skiing down a slope, and it will go, there you go. Mm-hmm. And that picture doesn't exist. It is completely virtual. It's completely artificial.
So, and you can again give it as many details as you want.
Yeah, you can say, make the children taller, make that person in blue, make it, et cetera, all that kind of stuff. And you can generate realistic stuff, but you can also generate complete fabrication. Like, generate a picture of a horse on skis, skiing uphill, mm-hmm. and it'll go, there you go. And that's an example of where the logic breaks down. We see it in the text when sometimes it gives you the wrong answer, what we call a hallucination. And likewise, we can get hallucinations in images. And one of the things that image generation has great difficulty with is hands. Because, it's a very dexterous part of our physiology. But generating hands artificially is usually the most difficult part. So we'll see artificially generated hands with six fingers, for example.
Okay. Alan, you're messing with my head now.
Alan Smeaton from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning on the Ryan Tubridy Show, the finalists of the Dancing with the Stars class of 2023.
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
Well, what a sensational final it was last night. Carl and Emily, let me just say congratulations to you
Thank
both.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for being here today. What's left of you
after
that extraordinary achievement. But let me also say to Brooke and Robert, welcome.
Hello. Hello.
And to Damien and Kylie, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And sending our best to Suzanne and Michael, who are somewhere else today. I hope they're enjoying
their... congratulations for us.
And congratulations. It's called a hotel room. Yeah. Not together, obviously. Well, but,
we don't know that.
Okay, hang on a second. There's 15 tabloid journalists outside and we can't make this story any worse than it already is. Let's start at the beginning. Carl, hearty congratulations to you. Your face was a picture when they announced that you had won. I mean, your jaw dropped to the ground.
Yeah.
And you seem to be quite shocked.
Incredibly shocked by the whole thing. Like, look, I said this last night, not on the show, but like, you know, we were doing interviews afterwards and I will be the first to say, I know technically I wasn't the best dancer. I think Brooke is an incredible dancer.
And just give it back. Give her the ball.
And Damien as well. Like, as in, it was last night as a final, it was just unbelievable. It's same as well with Suzanne, to even just be there. I was so busy enjoying last night. It was the first show that I truly enjoyed. It was just an opportunity to go out and have fun, and it was the least nervous I'd been the whole time. So when they called out our name, I kind of just couldn't believe it. It was, I just hope we didn't speak nonsense on the TV afterwards.
I was watching it. It just looked like it was actually really joyful because you seemed sincerely happy and puzzled by it all. Why did you say yes when they rang and asked, would you like to be in Dancing with the Stars?
Well, I nearly said no to it. I was actually very close to saying no to it. And it was my wife, Ash, who convinced me otherwise. And we would have watched the show for the previous five seasons before and loved it. But to be honest with you, I was going to say no because I just thought to myself, I'm going to make a show of myself doing this thing. I really didn't think I'd be able to.
You thought you'd be embarrassed.
Big time. And I didn't think I'd be able to dance. I didn't think I'd be able to do anything worth showing on the television. I just thought it would be a mess. And then, you know, I just thought to myself, after speaking to my wife, Ash, do you know what? There's nothing to lose, really, from throwing yourself into a situation like that. You can only learn something. You can only gain something from it. So decided to just throw myself into
it. You're a very funny guy. You're a very lovely person, actually, you know, off air as well. And to see you, your social media is very powerful, very strong, big following, because you're funny. And with that in mind, it strikes me as being you're somebody who is happy enough to let loose and to give it a go. So that's why ultimately Ash probably saw that in you and said, come on, get out there and have a bit of fun. But I do understand you are exposing a side to yourself that could be kind of embarrassing if you're awful at it. So you had to work pretty hard, I'd say.
Totally. And for me as well, it's very different, you know, embarrassing yourself and kind of having fun on Instagram, because it's little 15-second snippets. Yes, yeah. To do it on national TV on a Sunday night for 2 hours, you were thinking to yourself, this could be a disaster, yes. You know what I mean? But yeah, I just, you know, I'm so glad that I threw myself into it. I'm so glad that I did it because, you know, honestly, it sounds like it's made up. I really learned so much about myself doing it. It's such an intense process. You know what I mean? We were rehearsing for 10 hours a day. There was so much went into it. But for me, I didn't really realise how inwardly I struggled with my own confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, outwardly people think I'm a very confident person, which I am. You know, I can go into a room, I can chat to people, but every single week on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Emily would be the one having to be saying, I know you can do this. You're able to do this. Don't worry. You can.
When was your confidence challenged most?
Ooh, probably the tango on week 7, which was the dance we did where we were tied together. And it was like dancing with a third person.
Was that the one where you were on a lead? Oh, no, that was...
I was on the lead.
There was a few leads knocking around about it. Yeah. As I said, there's a few clubs in Soho want their leads back. But you were saying, sorry.
No, it was just... I think I had a couple of panics at that stage because you were thinking to yourself, oh God, this could go disastrously wrong. Because I remember when we were doing that dance, anytime we'd get it wrong, we couldn't really figure out where it had gone wrong. We'd have to go back about 20 steps to figure out, okay, how do we make sure that doesn't happen again? Because if we got tangled up in that rope, we were finished. Goose, so
That's why I thought, she's not here today, but Suzanne, when she had that meltdown at dance, and for her to come back the way she did every week, I thought it was really impressive.
Very impressive.
I felt that sickness where it's like getting an exam question and going, I can't remember everything I've studied for. And then, you know, it was a nice return. So, yeah, I can imagine that pressure, getting your card marked every week, just horrible.
And Ryan was impressed by Derry girl Brooke Scullion.
Damn, you can dance.
Well, thank you very much.
No, you're really, really brilliant. No, honestly, I loved the Greatest Showman dance that you guys did with Robert last. I loved particularly that bit where you at one point you went running through the... through the floor. Now, obviously, I'm not a dancer.
Through the floor. Which part are you talking about? I don't know.
It's really in the dancing world, like to say the running through the floor bit.
Yes, yes.
But you were like scamping. You were like two gazelles, and I thought, this is amazing. But you were. But that was just one. That I like that song anyway. But tremendous skill that you have dancing.
Thank you. Do you know? For me, I just fell in love with the sport. I really did. I don't want to stop now. Today, I don't want to dance. I'll be honest. Honest with you. Like, I really don't, but like I'm gonna miss it so bad.
Could you do us do a few moves now? Maybe just no, I'm joking. We're not a camera. She can't look at me.
The last twice.
Yeah, exactly. So did you have a highlight of all the dances you did? Was the one? What's your Desert Island dance that you'd do again and again if you could? The Greatest Showman is the correct answer. Robert,
there you go.
How was it for you this season? You were brilliant.
Oh, great, actually. It was very short as well because like I just stepped up.
He stepped up.
Yeah. You stepped up, you showed up, but you were terrific. You always are. You're a terrific dancer. And how did you find working with Brooke?
Yeah, it was very easy, actually. It was very easy because she was very talented with the dancing, with the moves and everything. Yeah. So I didn't struggle much, so.
Okay, great. I should say, Emily, you haven't even... It's like a weird dinner party. I haven't said hello to everybody yet. Emily, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I know that when you were paired up with Carl... Did you know Carl and had you met him before? And you probably had on the morning show and the breakfast show, I should say. How was it for you when you heard he was your man?
Amazing. So we did a little salsa before, didn't we? On the radio, we came in. Oh, yeah, yeah, came in. And we
Hang on. That's absolutely terrifying.
Let me just remember. You definitely still can dance.
The evidence is on the 2FM Instagram page. It was about 6 minutes of tragic salsa that we did last season when you. Had
throwing him under the bus. Yeah. All that dance experience he's got. No, it was honestly, from the minute they told me I had Carl, I was just delighted. Okay. Like, it's been so much fun. We've laughed every day. We've had an absolute blast, and I genuinely could not have chosen a better partner to have won it with.
10 hours a day.
Yeah, it was.
Mother of God, I couldn't spend that time with anyone I love.
And we never had a route.
We haven't. Robert's here.
Maybe the right person. Yeah. Sorry, Carl.
I was fully sure going into it you'd have rows and there'd be like times where you'd get sick of each other, but it never actually happened. Yeah.
No. Yeah, don't believe a word of that. No. let's say hello to Damien and Kylie. Damien, very nice to see you.
Yes, good to see you.
What a great decision for you to get involved in the programme, because we'd have seen you in Glee, of course. Yeah. You're wonderful in that.
Yeah.
And when you got the call for Dancing with the Stars, was it a, did you have to think long and hard, or was it a quick decision?
No, it wasn't quick at all, actually. Right, like, to be honest, I'd had conversations in years gone by and it just never like felt like the right time. But this time it just happened at the right sort of, whatever it was, I was just like, I actually fancy this. I sort of fancy the idea of a major challenge, because I am like genuinely naturally very, very awkward, and like I don't move well at all. Like, I was never ever gonna move like Brooke Scullion, and that was just the reality of it.
You could have fooled me. I would have thought you had dancing background, because you were pretty natural from the start.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I think we kind of went on our own journey, me and Kylie. Like, we kind of, like, Kylie built up a different kind of performer in me now, and like I feel more confident, and I'm really proud of like of what we've done. And
yeah, the judges repeatedly said about you week in, week out, that you are improving all the time. Yeah. I got that sense that they were watching your progression and were impressed by it.
I mean, we were just trying really hard. Like, we worked, we put so many, it's actually funny, at the rap party last night, everybody in the show worked hard, but one of the production coordinators comes up to me and goes, come here, she says, you and Carl put in the most rehearsal hours by a country mile. She says, on the schedule, it was always you and Carl. He's really horsed it out of the rehearsal studio.
And then she said, hey, shit, I'm getting you a cab. Kylie, how was it for you? I suppose it was a straightforward question.
It was an incredible experience. I've been a part of the show, this is my third year. So it was really amazing to be able to make the final with Damien, and to actually see the growth over the 11 weeks has been really amazing to see that someone can work so hard and grow so quickly. And there's just so much more that he can learn, and he can just be absolutely incredible. So,
Your Charleston was exceptional.
That was the worst week of my life.
Yeah, it was. And,
swivel.
It's like the longest hours we've most probably done.
Oh, like my Monday.
This is like marriage counselling now. It's like the worst week of my life. What happened to Charleston? Yeah,
like, most people can swivel naturally, but I just could not swivel naturally.
You're having swivel issues at home.
Oh, swivel anxiety. I've done about 4,000 swivels. Yeah, we finally got there in the end. But
obviously, the work pays off, and it really showed, you know, things like the Charleston. And as I say, it was a tough old week, but you loved it.
Thank you.
Damien McGinty and Kylie Vincent from The Ryan Tuberty Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the rise in the use of cocaine in Ireland, making us the fourth highest consumers of the drug worldwide.
Now, Irish people are close to the top of the list globally in cocaine use. This is according to a new UN report, which puts us in joint fourth place, the same as the US and Austria. Only Spain, the Netherlands and Australia are ahead of us. The report also points to concerns about the violence and intimidation that go along with dealing with this at a community level. Colin O'Gara, head of addiction services at St John of God Hospital and clinical professor of psychiatry at UCD, is on the line. Colin, thanks very much for taking our call this morning. I assume this is not going to be news to you, really.
Good morning, Claire. No, it isn't. I suppose what it does is it reflects what we've seen and heard from our patients for many years, particularly about the huge availability of cocaine. And generally, clinical problems follow when the availability of a drug goes up. You tend to get increased end harm. So you see that with alcohol, in particular nations, and end results like liver cirrhosis rates. But in terms of cocaine, all of our clinical presentations would suggest that you know, it is going up. And there's different cohorts to that. There's young, you know, young men taking cocaine in the context of a pub to drink more. And, you know, that's after several pints. You know, men will be taking cocaine just to freshen up, which is a terrible way to look at it. But that's exactly what they're doing. And then you've other cohorts, maybe of young women or gym going men who would be taking cocaine to because they don't want to be drinking alcohol. You know, it's not just a young person's issue, Claire, as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm kind of dealing with people who've never taken drugs before in their lives, and, you know, particularly in adolescence or as young adults, and then start taking cocaine in their 40s or 50s. And I have patients in their 60s taking cocaine and have, you know, potentially a lot of difficulties that go with that in terms of medical problems.
I'm just so surprised to hear that somebody in their 60s would start taking cocaine at that point in their lives. Is that what's happening? And if so, why?
Yeah, so if you look at, I mean, I'm not, you know, keen not to be pointing the finger at any particular sector, but I mean, because, you know, the data suggests that it is across all sectors, you know, and all professions. But if you took, for instance, somebody in the hospitality sector, you know, somebody in a particular profession, once you're out and about, what we're being told is that cocaine is now so readily available. It is normalized to a certain extent. And I mean, it's not short of, we're not seeing people. Well, in some circumstances, people are telling us that they're openly using. But I mean, it's all the while, it's the thin edge of the wedge in terms of usage is becoming more and more common, more normalized.
So it's acceptable. It's acceptable now.
Well, I struggle with the concept that it's, you know, I just can't get my head around how it's acceptable. I get that point. I mean, certainly if there's a lot of drink taken and there's somebody taking cocaine, I think 10 or 20 years ago, people would be saying, look at that. But now it's becoming more normalized. And again, it all comes back to this availability piece, that there's just so much of it out there. And it's not just an urban issue, Claire. You know, the we've seen that it's, you know, you would think that, oh, well, it's a party drug, it's associated with urban centers, but not the case. I mean, there's been a lot of focus on farming communities, the GAA. And, you know, there's not a town, you know, certain towns are affected. And that's what people are telling us, more so than others. But really, there's no place now in the country that isn't affected by high levels of cocaine.
And does it indicate that, I know some people are really struggling financially, but the last time there was a massive drop in cocaine use was just at the point of time when the crash happened in 2008. So if we're seeing this now, this increase, does that tell us that people have a bit of spare cash, or has the price come down?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Post the last crash, you know, 08 onwards, cocaine almost just fell off the edge of a cliff. It disappeared. So in terms of clinical work, from what we were doing, we saw the emergence of other probably more harmful drugs like methadone and methadrone. These were the head shop drugs and amphetamines and, you know, lots of drugs that can cause, like, now cocaine is a very dangerous drug. There's no doubt about that. It causes, in every age group, it causes serious cardiac arrhythmias and possibly strokes. If you see young people now attending stroke units in their 20s and 30s, it's the horrific effects. But, you know, as it's something, Claire, that we see, you know, the devastating effects following the economy. So, you know, if you know, the economy went down with the deep recession, we saw the emergency of these drugs. Then in 2014, as the economy improved, we saw quite an increase of cocaine to the point now where it is extremely available. The issue of price and whether it's going down is a very interesting point. I mean, it tends not to have gone down, according to our patients, that the price still remains as it was many years ago. There doesn't seem to be that dynamic going on. But again, a lot of our patients are buying cocaine in bulk, so they are getting deals on cocaine. But this report today focuses on a lot of, you know, the violence, intimidation that goes with cocaine. A lot of our patients are in contact with, you know, with dealers, and sometimes it's younger people's parents that are picking up the pieces in terms of having to pay off drug debt. So really a miserable situation. You know, it's not just the physical effects, the social consequences as well are quite significant.
Colin O'Gara from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, the live line was dominated by the issue of homeschooling. Monica was Joe's first caller.
Monica, the Taoiseach has said that the Enoch Burke case, we're not going to talk about that, obviously, is proof that homeschooling can cause isolation and that children should be educated in schools. You have homeschooled your 6 children.
I have indeed. They're now between the ages of 15 and 36. I've been home educating since 1986 when my first child was born.
And why?
Why? Because I just like my children and I like being with them, and I didn't want to miss out on their first word or their first tooth or their first step, and I didn't want to miss out on the magic of when they held a pencil and when they discovered that numbers made sense and when they could throw a dice and all that kind of stuff. So it was literally, for me, home education was the gift of time, and I really have been saddened to hear what the Taoiseach says, because I think it comes from a place of great prejudice. Home educators in this country are a minority, Joe. And, you know, I would imagine that our Taoiseach and our elected representative, they're meant to be protecting all the people of the country and protecting Bunrock na hÉireann. It was actually, I went through school myself, did my leaving cert, did well in school, was in college and left to be a full-time mammy when I was 19. And it was actually an English South African family who educated me that Bunrock na hÉireann, the Irish constitution, specifically says that Irish people are primary educators, parents are primary educators. Here, and that right is there, you know.
Okay. Why do so few people take up that right?
I guess at the moment it's so hard to have the blessing of a parent at home with the child, is what I hear from young parents today, that they would love to spend more time with their children, but actually just to keep a roof over their head.
Okay.
They need two wages coming in.
What reaction, Monica? What reaction did you get when you said you were going to homeschool your children?
Curiosity is the first thing you get from people. Oh, actually, the very first thing people say, the first thing they say to my children is, "I didn't know you were allowed to do that."
Okay. Well,
so the fact that it's actually a constitutionally protected right
we've established that. But what other challenges did you face?
Challenges, I suppose people's perceptions, yes, that we sat at the table at 9 o'clock and we opened the Irish book at 9:10 and we opened the maths book at 10 o'clock and this kind of thing. So we did what's called unschooling. So basically my children, their education at the start looks very much like your kids' summer holidays. Like, it looked like Lego and painting and drawing and going to the park and feeding the animals and just life, just, you know, helping mammy make scones. That's the big part of education. I want my kids, I have 5 sons, Joe, and I really didn't want to send anyone out into the world who thought that it was somebody else's job to make them food. Do you know, I've reared some decent cooks, I have to say, because they were all there just hands-on. It was time. Really, it's the gift of time. And if you can give that to your children, it's irreplaceable.
But there's lots of children who went to school who are good cooks.
Oh, of course,
aren't they?
There are.
And good at Lego and all
that's
that.
That's not the point, though.
But what about Micheál Martin's point that it gives them? Now, again, an isolated perspective. You disagree with that? An isolated perspective in life.
Okay, I would say if I wanted to isolate people, I would put 30 or 24 4-year-olds in one class with one adult and from 9 until 2 and expect good learning to come for those 30 individuals.
Okay.
Our kids were not isolated. Our kids were out at the grocery store. They were out in the library. They were out at the post office. They were chatting to older people, younger people. They were going to home education meetups. They were going to sports clubs. They were going to music groups. They were going to orchestra. They were meeting people all over the place. And they didn't think that because you were born in the same year as everybody else, that was the only person you could speak to. I don't know about you, Joe, but I do not at 55 socialise with 30 people anymore. I haven't had to do it since I left school. And most people have a couple of close friends, if they're lucky. And that's how we don't need to think of ourselves. Maura Mullarney wrote, anything school can do, you can do better. And Maura, bless her, she said that unless you're going to join a religious order, or as my daughter says, an orchestra, or the army, you never need to think of yourself as one of a group of 30 outside of school. It's a completely artificial socialising kind of setup.
And Jo asked Monica if her children sat state exams.
Some of them did. I never put a child through the junior cert, couldn't see the point of it. Okay. Apologies to all 15 and 16 year olds.
No, expand on it. No, give me a few sentences on that. Please.
Yeah. What?
You can't see the point in the junior cert.
Literally couldn't see the point. So I have, like, one is 36, one is 29, one is 27, one is 22, one is 19, and the youngest is 15. And none have done a junior cert. None will do a junior cert. The first two did leave in cert and then did various courses afterwards. The next three did VTAC 5 courses. They didn't go to official education until they were 16, did a one-year course at 16 and got into university to do degrees that way.
Okay. So for some people, the junior cert does matter, especially and especially for people from less well-off backgrounds, because...
100%. And we would have had at our home education network conferences. We would have Nuala Jackson, Owen Jackson, Fionnuala Jackson, the XLC project down in Waterford, fabulous people. And they said, the Leaving Cert doesn't matter. I remember some of the parents saying, the Leaving Cert doesn't matter. And she looked at the parent who said that and said, with your accent, it doesn't. But she said to the kids I'm dealing with in Waterford, inner city, it does. It's the rite of passage that they need. But, I mean, my late husband assumed, he was a secondary school teacher, he assumed all our kids would do a Leaving Cert. I assumed they'd all do university. We were both wrong. Our children taught us, you know.
And you mentioned your late husband, which I'm sorry to hear. And he was a teacher.
Secondary school, he taught metalwork. And woodwork then, when we moved down to Kilcullen, there wasn't a metalwork outfit in the school where he got the job, so he taught woodwork and maths. And the longer he taught in school, the more he valued home education and thought it was a pretty great choice for our particular family and our particular children. What I did, Joe, because I know a lot of people are very nervous about what happens at the end, and I get calls. I'm the local contact for people who are worried about their kids not fitting into school and wondering what to do, and they're scared. They're so scared. And I was very, very blessed that 16 young home educated adults in Ireland had a chat to me, and I recorded that and stuck it up on YouTube. It's under my name, and they just talk about how they learned to read and write. Most of them didn't have parents who sat them at the kitchen table from 9 until 3. I know very few families who do that, to be very honest with you, in the home education context. Like most of the education, if you take the regular 4-year-old, Joe, they ask about 467 questions. Somebody counted it from one end of the day to the next. Now, as their mother or father, you don't need to know all the answers, but you just need to go on a journey and find out the answers with them. And home education, my children, has been the greatest blessing and the greatest education of my life.
And did you ever, when you, because you have a different routine, as you said, and we'll go into that. But did you ever, when you say you'd be with your children of a morning at 11 o'clock, and obviously you're not in school, but you might have been walking to the park or coming out of a shop. Do you ever get people saying to you, why aren't they in school?
Of course. Okay. It's a great conversation starter.
And what do you say?
I'm home educated, some of my children will say to them, or we learn at home, or we learn out in the park, or we learn wherever we are, or we have different, depending on whether somebody wants a one sentence answer or they actually want to go into it. Oh my God, you can do that. That's something that you're actually able to do. And how does that work?
Can you get state help, Monica? Can you get specialised teachers?
Joe, come on now. I would actually love if somebody crunched the numbers sometimes. So from 1986 until now, having never put a child into primary school, what my family have saved the country in capitation grants. I think it'd be a nice little sum.
Well, that's Monica. Then Paul called Joe about homeschooling.
I just think what you call a homeschooling can stifle a child's emotional development. And sometimes parents lack objectivity, they're subjective. So there's a conflict there between parenting and schooling as well. And I just think it's quite unhealthy for a child to develop emotionally, psychologically, to become empowered. I think they need to be around other children, a tactile nature, psychologically, emotionally, being schooled with other children as well. And as I said, sometimes parents can be a little bit covetous. They think they know what's best for their own children, but really isolates the child as well, because they're cast adrift from their friends going to school on a Monday morning, Friday evening, coming home for the weekend. And I just think it's not a great idea.
But have you any experience of that, Paul?
Well, when I was five or six, okay. I would have been lucky to be homeschooled, but my parents said, no, you have to go to school.
No, but did you
ever... Sorry, I'm joking.
Okay, no bother. Did you ever meet anyone who was homeschooled?
I have met people who have been homeschooled, people that I knew of my generation, and there's a differentiation there between how people have developed as well. I think it does in some ways restrict their emotional development. It doesn't empower them. It doesn't strengthen them psychologically, emotionally, being at home, and it creates too much of a dependence on their parents as well. I just think it's unhealthy not letting children go out into a big bad world from Montessori, primary school, secondary school. I just think it's quite abnormal.
Hmm. Maybe, but yeah, it's unusual. I don't know if abnormal is a word, but it's unusual. Say what is
well,
Paul.
I think it's abnormal in the right context. I don't say that in a derogatory way.
I know that.
But it's outside the norm, you know.
Okay,
we have schools, we have structures in schools for a reason for human beings to develop, and that's deprived of children. Children can't choose for themselves at that age.
And then Anne called Joe about the Taoiseach's comments on homeschooling.
Well, I've homeschooled my children since 2010, and one of them is autistic.
Okay.
And I found it actually very offensive. And I also thought it was very narrow-minded because, in particular, neurodiverse children would actually find the socialising side of school extremely difficult.
Okay.
And in many cases, very damaging. Mm. And I would say that a lot of the groups that I'm involved with to do with home education, that I regularly see posts up there from people pulling their kids out of school because they just cannot cope with the school system, and particularly when they're neurodivergent. And I thought there was a whole sector of society that was just ignored in that comment.
And Anne, can I ask you as well, why did you decide in the beginning? Was it because your child was neurodiverse?
It's funny because my daughter wasn't actually diagnosed until she was sort of 12, between 12 and 14. I knew that she wasn't ready. I just knew there was something about her that was she was going to find it hard to cope. So I just kind of went down that path, and it was only as time went by and I just kind of was like, yeah, maybe there's something really going on here. And we went down the diagnosis route. Yeah. But yeah, she would have been so traumatised to go into that environment at the age of 4 and 5. My daughter had a really, really bad stammer between the ages of 3 and 4.
Okay.
And she speaks beautifully now. And I just, in the back of my mind, I think, would she be one of those autistic children that became voluntarily mute by being put into that stressful situation? My child didn't get phonics at all, and I taught her to read using a completely different reading method.
But is there
because she was home with me.
But just you said, is she one of those children who became voluntarily mute?
No, I said she could have been.
No,
she could have been because if she'd have gone into school because she had this huge...
Well, do we know of many children who've become voluntarily mute?
I do know of one, yeah. And it was actually, and again, he turned out to be autistic, funny enough, another late diagnosis. But yes, he went in and got us down to phonics, funny enough. He went in, couldn't cope with the whole phonics system, and just shut down.
Okay. And I don't want to know the child's name or situation.
No.
But how is the child now, do you know?
He's fine. I mean, I know his parents, she kind of took over.
Okay.
She took over the approach to reading, and he had to go for psychology appointments, and they went down, the roots of getting him a pet to try and bring him out of himself and all the rest of it. But yeah, and this is what it kind of gets me. People go on about school as being this, but you have to go to school to learn to socialise. But it's not always the great best place to learn to socialise, in my opinion.
That's Anne on the live line with Joe Duffy. Now, should concerts be happening earlier in the day, like a matinee? Claire Byrne thinks they should.
So Jamie Lee Curtis recently said she declined her invite to an Oscars nominee dinner because she'd rather go to bed early. And she said that if it's at 5 o'clock or later, she is not going. She was speaking on America's Today show. She said she'd rather see a gig at lunchtime rather than late at night.
I'm also challenging musicians to do concerts during the day. Why are there no matinees?
Matinees, yes!
I would love, for instance, I love Coldplay. Yeah. I would love to go see Coldplay. I would love it. The problem is, I'm not going to go see Coldplay if they start their show at 9 o'clock and there's an opening act. I want to hear Coldplay at 1 p.m.
Oh God, I'm so in favour of this. DJ Annie Mac brought her Before Midnight Club night to Dublin at the weekend. It was an event designed for those who want the party to end early. So the question is, and we're asking it today, should there be more early gigs and concerts? Well, Marty Guilfoyle, DJ and broadcaster, is with me here in the studio, and from our Galway studio, author and columnist with The Examiner, Edel Coffey. Good morning to you both. Thank you for joining us. So I am just not going to be the person who's on the fence here with this one, Marty and Edel. Edel, I am with you and I am with Jamie Lee Curtis, and I am very proud of this because early gigs are the way forward. It's such a good idea.
Early everything, Claire, in my opinion. I mean, I first hit on this idea out of sheer desperation and exhaustion a few years ago when my children were very young, and if somebody had suggested to me that I go for dinner, somebody, namely being my husband, at 8 o'clock, I would actually feel like bursting into tears at the thoughts of, you know, having to go out and get home late because I was so tired. So I just had this idea, oh, why don't we do a date day instead of a date night? And, you know, we booked the babysitter from 4 to 9. We went into town. We had a stroll. The shops were all open, so we had a look in the shops. We went for dinner at 6. And then after dinner, we went for a drink at the pub, and we were home by 9. And the children were asleep, and we woke up feeling fresh as a daisy the next day. And it was such a lovely day out that we started doing that a lot at that time because it really worked for us in our lives. But now I really, I love going out early. If somebody suggested me to go for a drink at 9 p.m, I'm out, and I'm really furious with myself if I kind of pre-agreed without actually checking what time it's at.
Oh my God, Marty, why are you so horrified?
9 o'clock. Oh my God,
I'm great o'clock. Fun. You should see me at 6 a.m.
Getting up to go, or is that when you're coming home? Like,
getting up for the day. That's what we have to do at our stage of life. But Marty, for you, that 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. that's not a night out, is it?
Oh God, no. That 4 p.m. So like I was actually WhatsApping a friend of mine there. I haven't spoken to him in a while, and I got back to him, must have been at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I sent him a voice note, and he messaged me back, and he was like, are you eating your dinner while you send me this voice note? And I was like, yeah, it was 1 a.m. when I would have my dinner. So he was like, oh yeah, I forgot that your body clock is on the other side of the day. I can't imagine a nightclub opening during the day. I just can't see it happening, or even working, as in, just from a point of view from what I do. Mm-hmm. You know,
and yet those Annie Mac shows have sold out. Like now they're 7 till midnight, so that's slightly later, but
too late
really
for you,
popular,
Adele.
I'd have to rule myself out of that now.
It's like I'd be all for the 7 o'clock one, because obviously during the pandemic, when restrictions were being eased and stuff, and we were able to open nightclubs again, but we had the earlier closing times. I did enjoy it, I have to say. There was a part of me doing gigs for the last 12 years that I was like, okay, I'm home at a respectable time now after a nightclub gig. I'm going to bed by 1 o'clock in the morning. I know that might still sound a little bit too late for you, but that to me was very early.
And you felt better.
I did feel better. Yeah. I did. I really, really did. I was getting a really good sleep. I was getting up at 9 o'clock in the morning, which again would be very early for me. But like even coming in here this morning, my alarm went off at 9:30 and I was like, oh my God, what is this?
That's Edel Coffey and Marty Guilfoyle from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.